Good morning, and welcome to the June 21st Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. I'm Commissioner Mark Samulin, honored to serve as the chair of this committee. I am joined by my colleague, Commissioner Gongora. Commissioner Areola, given it's a hybrid meeting, will be doing a hybrid. He will be here for most of the meeting. He is online at this moment in time. And we're also delighted to be joined by our colleague, Commissioner Minor. We have a number of people helping us, including our staff liaison, Tom Mooney. For those who want to participate, there are a few people who are in the audience. There's a Zoom link. That webinar ID is 850-5992-3037. And phone number, two choices, I'll give you the toll-free, 888-475-4499. Let's begin with any announcements we have. Tom, any announcements you'd like to share, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. The first is under discussion items number four, the update on projects on West Avenue, Indian Creek, Palm and Hibiscus, and First Street. That's being deferred to the July 12th Land Use Committee meeting, so that will not be discussed today. Secondly, we will begin the agenda with a time certain of item number 8 at 9 o'clock, which is an ordinance amending Chapter 126 of the Miami Beach City Code pertaining to Chapter 126. And then that will follow with item number 7 regarding the environmental impacts of the Urban Forestry Master Plan. After that, we will be taking up items number 2 and number 3. Those are the only announcements I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that, Tom. Without further ado, then, let's begin with item 8, an ordinance amending Chapter 126. Commissioner Minor is the sponsor. Commissioner, would you like to kick us off or hear from the administration?
Yes,
Commissioner Gongora.
Thank you. Item number 8 is related to a request from the Lagoras Island Association. I have learned, although I've never done any work for them, that one of my law partners serves as General Association Counsel for Lagoras Island, and as such, the city attorney has recommended that I recuse from item 8, but not item 7. So I'm going to step outside for 8, and somebody let me know when we're done, and I'll come back.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Gongora. Commissioner Marnie, would you like to tee us up or have the administration do so? Okay, go ahead.
I'll wait for Commissioner Gongora to fully leave. So this came out under our current city plan. We are actually changing our current tree population from 57% palm tree to 25% palm tree. And that's going to be occurring through several different ways. One is there are 22 projects that have been identified as removing approximately 1,000 trees and relocating several hundred others. There's also an additional 23 projects that are in the pipeline that are either in the planning, construction, or design phase that will also remove scores of palm trees, but as yet determined number. And under our current laws, when palm trees are removed from a street or a neighborhood, when replanting trees, the palm trees don't count toward the credit that given toward our street canopy. So basically, in essence, what's going to happen is there's going to be a sort of phasing out, so to speak, or reduction of palm trees over time. Even though the city is adding palm trees in certain areas, at least the list that that's been provided to me and is available publicly. The majority of those are going to be in a couple of parks. So there's definitely going to be an impact on our neighborhoods and our residential neighborhoods and our commercial corridors. So although I'm supportive of the city's plan to add shade trees and canopy trees, I think that's all good, and I think it's necessary. There are also some issues that we also need to discuss, and that's going to be item 7 that we need to consider when we're making such a change to our tree canopy and our tree population. What I am proposing under this ordinance is that we allow certain neighborhoods to preserve their historic landscaping, specifically palms, but it could be any landscaping, and do that through a legislative amendment that would allow certain neighborhoods to be added to what we're calling an appendix, but basically would allow that residential neighborhood, if they come and they sort of come to us and want to be added to that list, they'd have that right. And basically, what it would allow for them to use palm trees to count toward their tree canopy, which under the current law they would not allow. So under a new construction project or under or for tree dies, they don't get credit for adding a palm tree. So this would give an opportunity, because basically under the current ordinance, it's a one size fit all for our entire city, and it doesn't allow for certain historic preservation and cultural preservation of really one of our iconic brands in Miami Beach. So that's sort of teeing it up how I see it, and I guess I'll allow legal or the administration to opine. I do want to mention we have some residents from Lagoras Island and council for Lagoras Island here as well, and they'll speak, but also keep mindful that I've heard from many, many residents throughout our city, who are interested in potentially. I don't want to overstate it how many neighborhoods it is. Right now, Lagoras Island has sort of taken a strong lead on this, but there are other neighborhoods as well that might be interested in the historic preservation of their palm trees.
Thank you for that introduction, Commissioner Minor. Certainly, look forward to hearing from either the administration or the city attorney's office. And as always, let's hear from that group first, then we'll open it up for a public comment. If you have a comment on this item in person or online, we'll do 2 minutes. Just raise your hand online. I'll recognize you, and we'll take it from there. But first, let's hear from...
For this item, Mr. Chair, for item number eight, Commissioner Minor did a good job of explaining exactly what the nature of the ordinance is. This particular ordinance is an amendment, to Chapter 126. There's a companion item that would amend Chapter 46 that will be heard by the Neighborhood Committee on June 30th. And this particular ordinance amendment, since it's an amendment to the LDRs, would require the review and approval of the Planning Board. So if the Land Use Committee is in favor of this ordinance, you would make a recommendation that the City Commission then refer the item to the Planning Board. So from a sequencing standpoint, this ordinance would first have to go to the Planning Board and then come back to the City Commission for two readings. As we've indicated in the LUSC memo, the administration, while not in favor of the proposal, we do think that if it does move forward, we would recommend some tweaks to it to ensure that the objective of the type of palms that are proposed are actually included, either as part of an overlay or if an Appendix F is created. Because right now, as it is drafted, it's not specific to the type of palm that would be proposed, the minimum graywood standards, things of that nature. So we think that in order to achieve that objective, that's something that should be added to it. The legislation was drafted by the city attorney's office, and the city attorney has taken a look at the proposal that's before you. I don't believe that there's any issues from a legal standpoint. So at this point, unless there's any questions about the memo, I think we could go ahead and hear from the members of the public.
Yeah, Tom, I actually have a couple questions, and then perhaps Commissioner Areola may or may not have any questions before. Two questions. First, could you just talk a little bit about the companion ordinance at neighborhoods, status, relationship to this item? So that's one. And then second, if you had to sort of give us the executive summary of what this ordinance does, we heard from Commissioner Minor. He did a fine job. I would also like to sort of hear from you how you would sort of summarize the essence of what this is doing.
Sure. Basically, the major change that's proposed in Chapter 46 would be to create, would be to allow for palm trees to be characterized as heritage trees. Right now, under Chapter 46, heritage tree designation is limited to canopy trees. This would allow for for palm trees on a case-by-case basis to be eligible for heritage tree designation. And it would also amend those sections of 46 regarding minimum canopy to be consistent with Chapter 126. Commissioner Minor explained the proposal to 126 very accurately. It would basically create an Appendix F, which would allow for different neighborhoods to be added to a separate appendix that would allow for those specific neighborhoods and those neighborhoods alone to have their palm trees count toward minimum canopy requirements. And in order to modify Appendix F in the future, that would be done by resolution, which would be a majority vote. So you wouldn't have to amend the LDRs every time you wanted to add a neighborhood. Appendix F would be created under Chapter 126, and then in the future, should another neighborhood want to add their area to Appendix F, it would be by a majority vote of the commission through resolution.
Thank you for that, Tom. Just to follow up, the memo talked about the potential adverse impact on meeting some of our goals as it relates to urban forestry master plan. Could you just bring to life what the concerns the administration has?
Our biggest concern collectively, and this is both the planning, the environmental, and the public works department, is that we think it's critical that the city meet its goal of 22% tree canopy over the next 20 years. And we believe that's attainable, and we believe that you will still see a growth in palm trees, but that's primarily what our concern is, and that's why we would have a concern with modifying the code in a manner that would allow for palm trees to be counted as minimum canopy because of the potential impact on that goal.
Okay. Thank you for that. Commissioner Arriola, I don't know that I see your hand, so unless you have anything you want to add at this moment, I'd like to open it up for the public. If you have a question, I'd recognize you, but I think I don't see your hand, so I think we're going to move to the public. We have folks in the room and online. Let's start with the folks in the room. Each person will be allowed 2 minutes to speak to us and give us your perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this mic on? Yep. Good morning. Wes Hevia, Ackerman, LLP. Law Office of 98 Southeast 7th Street, Miami, Florida 331, here on behalf of the Lagorse Island Association, Inc. We have actually last week we submitted a letter to commissioners on this subject, not exactly this legislation, but addressing the problem that we are facing at Lagorse Island. And I'd like to hand that out, if you don't mind, and after my statement, so that it becomes part of the legislative file. But in short, Lagorse Island actually presents a really good case study for what we think the purpose behind this legislation is. And that is, there are certain, so the Urban Forestry Master Plan sets forth certain citywide objectives concerning canopy. And certainly those objectives are worthy, but they're sort of agnostic as to cultural and historic landscaping, things that hold value to people beyond, you know, merely the science behind certain canopy trees versus palm trees. And Lagorse Island is a great example of a place where, for basically its entire history, has had these sort of iconic rows of royal palm trees throughout its right-of-ways that the residents really cherish and are really important to the identity of the island. And in fact, the island took the time to hire Paul George to do some research and sort of document that, and that's part of our letter as well. However, you know, due to the legislation that has been put forth as a result of, you know, the recommendations in the Urban Forestry Master Plan, the palm trees on the island will be eroded over time. It's a fact. And that's the major concern here. And that's why we are in strong support of this legislation, because it would essentially identify and carve out areas of the city, such as Lagorse Island, where there are palms worthy of preservation. And that's really the word that we would use. So we, again, we're joined by several residents from the island who will also speak. I see my time is concluded, and I would like to hand this out so it becomes part of the record.
Sure. Please,
okay.
Please
thank you.
It out. If others would like to speak at this time.
If I may approach.
Of course.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dennis Kanan. Except for a 10-year exile in Coral Gables, I have lived on Miami Beach since 1960. And in particular, latest incarnation since 1993. I am a resident at 6645 Brevity Lane. I'm a lawyer practicing at Weisberg, Kane, and Mark. I speak on behalf of the island as a member of the board and also as a longtime resident. I can't help but notice, Mr. Chair, that behind you are two icons. There's the Great Seal of the City of Miami Beach, that happens to have a palm tree, and then I see next to that, to my right, also a palm tree in the flag of the seal of the City of Miami Beach. In particular, I would ask, Mr. Chair, have you had the opportunity to walk through the streets of Lagoras Island?
Yes.
Wonderful. So I would suggest that anyone else on the committee who has not had that opportunity, you are all welcome to come, and we're happy to give you a tour. In particular, what is concern to us is that the argument being made on behalf of the staff of the city appears to be that they're concerned about impacting the 22%, this 22% goal. I see no reason why that would be impacted with a more robust and vigorous planting of trees in other parts of the city. You're going to hear and you've read about the historic nature of the trees. Let me just point out one thing from the document that was given to us, where it says within the body of what the city wrote, for instance, if palms within a given neighborhood experience disease or pests, it may be difficult to replant a different species that is less susceptible to such disease or pests. I think that's just a straw man argument. What in essence it's saying, if we send you to college and you don't succeed, we've wasted our money. If you don't succeed with the trees being diseased, we've wasted this ordinance where we've permitted you to keep the trees. Thank you very much. I see I'm up with my time, and I appreciate, we're very strongly believe that the historic nature of Lagoras Island should maintain its beautiful royal palm trees. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. It's nice to finally meet you, Tom. My name is Esther Egozi Shakroon. I reside at 21 Lagoras Circle, and I have been, I was born on Miami Beach, so I've lived on Miami Beach all my life, and the last 28 years on Lagoras Island. And so for those of you that have visited, obviously it's a very special and unique place, specifically because of our streetscapes. I'm also today the manager for the association, and so in my capacity as manager, I interview all the newcomers to the island, the prospective buyers, and I'm always curious to know why they're interested in coming to Lagoras Island. And I have to say that without exception, everyone, of course, is very concerned about the security, but without exception, it's the beauty, it's the unique character of the island, it's those beautiful green viewscapes. And the truth is that the city does need to increase the canopy. I think nobody is contesting that. It's the fact that on the island, we can do that in other areas. We can certainly do as much as we can on private property, but when it comes to the swale, it would be a shame to infringe on a plan that this was the way the island was conceived. This was part of the original landscape plan of the island. All of the cables were buried from day one, meaning this was the initial intent, and why would we want to change that when it's so beautiful, it's so unique, and we can certainly work with you in other ways to find other options to meet the requirements of the city as refers to the Urban Forestry Master Plan, including contributions to the tree fund, which, you know, we think many of the residents would be amenable to. So talking of the seal, our logo also includes a royal palm. And we feel very strongly, I'd lastly like to say that resident Jared Galbit, residing at 6655 Pine Tree Lane, couldn't make it this morning, and he asked that I please also say that he's very, very supportive, and this is definitely one of the reasons why he acquired on the island as well. Thank you all for your time.
Okay. Thank you. We are going to, come on up, sir. I was thinking we were almost there, but let's continue. Commissioner Ariola, I see your hand is up, but I'd like, we have maybe one or two more folks in the public. I see at least one hand online, so if it's okay, let's close out the public and we'll bring it back to the virtual dais. Ricky, if that's all right. Sir.
Thank you very much. My name is Joseph Z. Fleming, and my wife and I reside at 6655 Sheffield Lane on Ligoris Island. I've lived on Miami Beach since I was born in 1941, and I'm 80 years counting. And I'm still not older than the royal palms that have been described as dying at 8 years, which are still on Ligoris Island. They were on Ligoris Island when Betty Grable and Don Ameche in the movie Moon Over Miami drove through Ligoris Island, and they're still there. They're iconic, historic, and they're beautiful. They're not foreign or exotic. Like myself, although they were born earlier, and I'm sure they're going to survive me, these royals and dates on Ligoris Island are indigenous. If you went down to the Florida Keys, you would see them. If you went to the Everglades on the west side where there's salt water, you would see them, and there's a royal palm hammock on the west coast. If you went to the royal palm hammock on the east coast of the Everglades, you would see them in the royal palm hammock, which is part of the park. So they survive in fresh water, as on the east side of the Everglades, and they survive in salt water. They've also survived on Ligoris Island because of the fact that I've seen them in hurricanes and other situations survive when the water that salt rushes over and when the water that's fresh washes over. If I could have another minute, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. We'll...
So basically, these trees are hardy, and while the city has been concerned about the fact that they may be one type of a tree and they may create some problem, the same city and its staff have suggested that maybe they could improve the ordinance by making sure that when the royals are down, which might happen, they be replaced by the same royals. So there's a little inconsistency there. The city has opposed the section that I support that's before you in item 8. But item 8 is good because the best is the enemy of the good in many situations. Of course it would be better if the city staff would come forward and say that Ligoris Island is a jewel, that these are historic, that they need to be preserved. I suspect at some point that's why they wrote their report, that we could do better. But the point is that when I got involved, I basically checked with the Florida Audubon Society. I spoke with people there and people that taught landscape at Harvard and made them available to the city. No one has ever called on them except for Commissioner Minor. And there's historic evidence and there's environmental evidence that shows that we should be able to have on Ligoris Island a very special situation. And it's not just for Ligoris Island. We have bicyclists who come from the city tours from all over. We have walkers from North Bay Road, from Ligoris, the Drive, from Pine Tree, from Aqua. These people are walking on our island every day, and they're there because it's very special. We'd like you to preserve it. Thank you very much for the extra time
of
and
course.
Your consideration.
Thank you, sir. Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Daniel Seraldo here on behalf of Miami Design Preservation League. We know that this issue about historical preservation has been coming up related to the palm trees, so I just wanted to share some thoughts. We have not yet taken an official position on the palm tree versus the shade tree component, but I think you've heard evidence from the residents that this is a neighborhood that has historical significance. I don't think anyone mentioned yet, but sometimes we take for granted the beautiful homes that are there as well that I think even more than the palm trees really add to that beauty of that neighborhood. Unfortunately, so many of those are being knocked down and sent to landfills, and I think the neighbors are starting to see that the environment matters. And so to the extent that we can protect that environment in that sense, that DNA that makes a neighborhood so special, I think is worthy of further exploration. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Daniel. Seeing no one else at the public wishing to speak in front of us, let's turn to our virtual dais. I believe I only see one hand up. That's Mitch Novick. Mitch, you're recognized for 2 minutes.
Thank you, Commissioner Samuelin. I appreciate what all the speakers had to say today. I do want to state that coconut farmer Henry Lum came to Miami Beach in the 1860s and purchased all the land south of today's 14th Street for a cost of 35 cents an acre and planted some 300,000 palm trees. Ultimately, he sold his holdings to John and James Lummis, who created Lummis Park, which has the most contiguous amount of palm trees found anywhere within the United States in terms of a public park. To my surprise, you guys have allocated $500,000 to planner Bernard Zaskovich and Associates, who recently produced a plan or presented a plan which calls for a roadway to be relocated right through our historic linear Lummis Park. I would ask that that plan be scrapped, Ocean Drive be reopened to vehicular traffic. As you all are aware, there was a brutal street fight just on Saturday night on 9th and Ocean Drive. You turned my neighborhood into an absolute cesspool with these street closures, and I would ask you to do what is ever necessary to protect the integrity of the palm trees and Lummis Park. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Mitch. I don't see anyone else from the public. Let me just double check. And Nick from the city attorney's office will keep me honest. I don't see anyone else. So we're on the virtual dais here, and there's two of us. So Commissioner Areola and I had the situation at finance and found a way to work through things. Let's see if we can keep that same progress going. Ricky, I believe your hand's been up. You've been patient. Do you want to weigh in here?
Mark, give me a second because I'm on the Julia Tunnel and the reception spot. I need about 30 seconds, so if you want to talk for a sec, I'll chime in a minute.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Minor, would you like to be recognized?
Sure. I'll fill up the space until Commissioner Areola is ready. And I think this has been a good discussion. And really, this is about preservation of an historic and cultural landmark of our city. It also significantly impacts our economic brand, as our speakers and the Homeowners Association from Lagoras Island pointed out, not in their neighborhood, but also our seals and our flag. We are known for our palm trees, and I can go on and on the impact it has. I think the average person recognizes that. It's also important to note, and I think some of it's been mentioned, that the sway of the palm trees also has made it resistant to hurricanes. They're salt and drought tolerant. As Mr. Fleming mentioned, a lot of our royal palms are over 80 years old, so they've clearly survived many hurricanes. So for many other reasons, and really what this is about is allowing every neighborhood to have the right to preserve their historic character of their neighborhood, which includes palm trees, and that a one-size-fits-all policy may not always be the right thing. But I also want to give an example. I think the 41st Street example, which came up months ago and our commission considered, is instructive, because in that case, there's 251 palm trees on 41st Street, and the design called for the removal of 76 of those palm trees. Most of the shade trees to be added were not on 41st Street. They were actually on the side streets, and nobody was having any objection to that. So the shade trees were going to be added. The removal of the palm trees mostly had to do with the design feature and expanding sidewalks. And ultimately, I brought this to the commission, and there was much debate, and ultimately we got it down to approximately 30 palm trees from the 76. But that's an instructive example. That situation would not have impacted the shade trees and the 22% that we're trying to get to. And nobody's arguing here that we shouldn't get to this 22%. But sometimes the trees are being removed for other reasons other than just adding the shade tree. Another example And actually, I was recently on the mayor's Ocean Drive panel that Mr. Novick mentioned. And Bernard Zichkovich presented his plan, and it did show a design where the palm trees were essentially absent from the Loomis Park area. And I was on the call, and I had not even said anything, and many of the participants noticed the absence of the palm trees and were not happy and had spoken up about it, which was, again, without my prompting it. So it's definitely something our residents are mindful of. And really all this ordinance does is allow a neighborhood to come forward and be added into that historic preservation. I guess there's two ways. The city administration had brought up an overlay district, but that may be fine in some circumstances, but the problem with that is it starts the process over anew every time there may be a neighborhood. And I'm not sure how many neighborhoods there are going to be. Right now we have Lagoras Island here. I don't know how many or if there will be other neighborhoods. It just allows the opportunity. And to have an appendix that we can F, it's still going to require 4 commission votes to amend, to pass a resolution to add to the appendix. So it's not something that's going to happen easily. There's certainly going to be debate and consideration and discussion with that neighborhood, but it would allow for it, and I think that's the way we should go, because that's what we are as a city. We listen to our residents, and we allow for the preservation. I mean, these are two major features of who we are as policymakers, and I think that's the way we should be going.
Thank you for that, Commissioner Minor. Commissioner Arriola, we'll see if the cell phone service is allowing us to continue in a good way here. You want to take a shot at it, Ricky?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. I'm only a couple minutes away, but yeah. thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Minor, for bringing this up. This has been a fun discussion. I really didn't know what to make of this, and I'm glad we used Lagoras Island as an illustrative example, because I think the residents that spoke are right. I mean, when you think of Lagoras Island, you do think of those palm trees, and, you know, they are the neighborhood. And, you know, to remove them and replace them with something else would fundamentally change the neighborhood. And I think we need to tread lightly when we go that route. And what I'd like to ask administration is to, you know, help us come up with some happy medium here where we can preserve the character of neighborhoods and still achieve our ultimate goal of increasing the tree canopy throughout our city, because one size does not fit all. I agree with that statement. And, you know, I don't know ultimately if there's a right or wrong approach to this, because if we think about other neighborhoods in our community, such as like Flamingo Park, that has this amazing tree canopy, which, you know, is not really about palm trees, but, you know, other trees that provide a heavier canopy, and that's the character of the Flamingo Park neighborhood. It's beautiful, it's shady and cool, but other parts of our city that maybe are on the water, that are less dense, palm trees are appropriate. You know, across the bay, if you go to neighborhoods like Coconut Grove, parts of Coral Gable that are really leafy, they're not palm tree intensive, and they're quite beautiful. So I think if we could have a tailored approach that has significant resident input as to what they want, and then we can weigh that against what our professional staff is recommending, and we try to have a meeting of the minds, and then we just call it for a vote, that while it's a little bit more cumbersome of a process, I think we ultimately end up in a better place. So that's kind of where my head's at on this.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Arriola, and you actually did a great job at sort of summarizing where my thoughts are. I appreciate what the goals of the citywide plan are, but I'm always open-minded about tailoring to particular neighborhoods. So I like everything that you just said, that we would like the administration really to come back to us on when there may be needs for tailoring. But I'd like to just say something. It was sort of inherent what you said. I think Lagoras Island particularly is the case study. Sometimes we talk about concepts and ideas without any sense of how it worked. Here, there is an example of how it worked, because I have walked that island. That is an enormously precious, special place, and I want to see how do we take what the residents want in that area and apply it. Now, I don't know if that is exactly using this ordinance, as Commissioner Minor has articulated. I don't know if that is some sort of landscape overlay that we would do. But I think the message of the committee, at least if I can paraphrase Commissioner Arreola, is that we are intrigued to learn more about how we might tailor neighborhood-specific. And in this case, you know, given the unique nature of that island, we'd like to bring that back specifically to pressure test that approach, because that island deserves that protection. And I would request that the administration bring that back to the next meeting. Ricky, are you okay? I sort of paraphrased a little, added a point or two. Are you okay with that as a summary?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. And Tom, do you have what you need from this body today?
Yes, just to confirm, you're going to continue the item to the July 12th meeting with direction to the administration to come back with a more tailored approach to Lagorse, but also a tailored approach that could that would balance the needs of the Urban Forestry Master Plan with future neighborhood needs for any future overlays in the future.
That's exactly right. That you summarized it perfectly, Tom. Okay. Okay. So with that, this item will be coming back next month. So that
that'll be by acclamation.
Yes, that's okay. By acclamation. Commissioner Arreola and I, the two voting members, are in full agreement with that. So thank you for all that good discussion on item number 8. We're now going to pick up item number 7, which also had a time certain. The environmental impacts of the Urban Forestry Master Plan. Commissioner Reiner, it's good you're here. Your item is up next.
Thank you. And I put this on there. I had put on a number of related items dealing with the sort of in correlation with the ordinance that we just discussed. So, again, overall, the Urban Forestry Master Plan, I voted for it. I support it. It's a good plan. But I think there needed to be some more additional discussion about things we need to do to make sure that we implement it in a safe manner. So, for example, when I was doing a lot of my research for the ordinances, it came to my attention that when adding shade trees, the leaves that could fall from the shade trees and the nutrients that are produced from those leaves when they break down, if they get into our stormwater system and make their way into our water system, such as Biscayne Bay, they could cause, actually, and they do cause a tremendous amount of damage, including the algae blooms that we've recently seen. So the city obviously is aware of that, and we take steps to mitigate that. But there's an expense to that, too. They need to be cleaned up, the leaves, to make sure that doesn't happen. And really, this is a discussion about that to try to make sure that we take all the steps necessary to make that happen. I thought it was worthy of a discussion because, for example, we talk about the amount of rainfall that shade trees soak up as opposed to palm trees, and it's certainly an accurate statement, there's no question. But again, in doing my research, I realized that in the totality and the impact that it makes, it's really de minimis. The amount of rainfall that our trees soak up is, I actually don't have the statistics in front of me. I had it at the workshop, but I believe it's less than 0.1% of the amount of rainfall. But I'll get that exact number for next time. But so again, it's an accurate statement, but in totality, as we make these changes to our city, and again, this relates to the prior ordinance, and we make potentially major changes to the landscaping of our city and moving, sort of phasing out palm trees, so to speak, we just need to be mindful of the potential harmful impacts of the Urban Forestry Master Plan and the costs that are attenuated to that.
Thank you, Commissioner Minor. Let's hear from the administration as it relates to this.
Good morning. Elizabeth Wheaton, Environment and Sustainability Director. Trees provide many environmental benefits, everything from removing ozone from the air, storing carbon, to to reduce the amount returning to the atmosphere as greenhouse gas, shading and cooling streets and buildings, intercepting and absorbing stormwater, improving water quality by filtering and removing pollutants, as well as providing wildlife. I also want to note that real estate values increased by 7 to 10% where we have shade canopy. As we think about a sustainable urban forest, it is important to look at the diversity of species. Standards call for no more than 30% of one particular family to make up a city's canopy. In Miami Beach, Ariaceae, which is palms, the family of palms, make up 57%. So as we're thinking about how do we develop a sustainable urban forest, it's creating a more diverse canopy overall, and that includes a combination of both palms and canopy trees. As we think about nutrients, because I know that that was where this had come from, is nutrients entering the system from trees, I want to note that we have only 2% of our tree canopy, which is deciduous, which would lose their entire canopy over the course of the year, 2%. Semi-deciduous, 11%, while evergreen canopy makes up 30% of the canopy. So that means that these trees would only lose their leaves when as they continue to grow. I also want to note that inputs of nitrogen and phosphorus mainly come from fertilizer and pet waste, not leaves. And most palm trees require multiple applications of fertilizer throughout the year to sustain its nutritional needs, as opposed to canopy trees that do not require fertilizers once they are established. We have our public works team, which is responsible for street sweeping. They have street sweeping operations every single day of the year, as well as of cleaning our stormwater system. Miami Beach has the most robust stormwater maintenance system in Miami-Dade County, and I would argue in the entire state of Florida, which this is an important component in removing leaf litter before it enters the bay. And that is all of my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's before we open to the public, let's see if either my colleagues has any questions. They're not shy, so I hadn't heard it. But Betsy, while you're there, I do have a couple for you, if I could. Could you talk? You made the argument for diversity, and the memo says that no one tree type should make more than 30%. Could you elaborate on that? What are the benefits of that diversity?
Sure. So it's actually very interesting. Omar, our urban forester, he just got back from vacation, and he was in Texas. As many of you know, there was a major frost event that they had, and most of the palm trees, if not all of them, were killed during that frost. So you have environmental factors, which can impact tree species. You have pests and disease. So everything from funguses that can impact trees to pests such as whitefly that can impact the tree canopy. What happens is when we have an outbreak, if you have too many species from one particular family, it will cause potentially a full wipeout because the ability for that disease to spread quickly throughout the forest can occur. So a reason that we look to diversifying the tree palette is to prevent potential future losses. And again, the Urban Forestry Master Plan calls for a mix of species. For example, through our tree permitting program, new developments come in and they apply for a tree permit and are required to add back canopy onto their property. In the past 3 years, through the tree permitting program, we've added over 83% more palms than were on those properties prior to coming to get a permit. And that's because when properties redevelop, they're required per code to add tree canopy, but they also many want to add palms, in which we assist and help through the design process to make sure that they get that diverse palette.
And just a question related to that adding of the palms. In round numbers from the plan, about how many palms do we have today? And over the planning horizon, how many would we have if we implement the plan that we have?
Sure. So we currently have 57% of our canopy is comprised of palm trees. The idea would be to continue to add shade trees in order to increase the shade canopy. And of course, over time, we're also going to see an increase in palms as well, but not at the same extent as the addition of shade canopy.
I'm sorry, just to be clear, do we know the actual numbers, like how many palm trees, not the percent, the absolute number of trees palmed today and in the future? Do we have that?
I want to say it's 49,000. Is that correct?
Trees and palms in our public inventory. So 57% of that is palms.
So we have 49,000 trees overall on public property. 57% of those would be palms. I can do the math. Not in my head, though.
Okay. Because part of this is we're adding trees, right? That's the mix is shifting, but we're adding more trees. I was just trying to get the net of where we end up on the palms.
So right now we have 27,930 palms.
And do we know or what we end up with in terms of palms when we're done?
You know, this isn't an end up with. Rather, it's a goal. So what we're saying is, ideally, we want to increase our overall canopy from 17% to 22%. How do we get there? A big piece of that is adding additional canopy coverage. And so it's looking at neighborhood projects, it's looking at park projects, and as we develop the design, it's adding in more canopy at the same time as using palm trees as focal point and accent, so we continue to have that palm and lush vibe that we're used to here in Miami Beach. So it's just a rethinking of what the dominant species are so that we get the maximum environmental benefits as well as quality of life benefits that trees provide.
Okay, thank you, Betsy. That's very helpful. I'm not seeing anyone from the public. This is a discussion item, so I don't believe we're set up to take any action. Commissioner Miner, you go.
I'm going to hand it over to Omar.
Hello, good morning. This is Omar, urban forester for the city. The standard comes from an urban forestry initiative. Essentially, you don't want more than 10% of a specific species, 20% of a specific genus, and 30% of a specific family. And the reason for that, once again, is to help manage a sustainable urban tree canopy within your city. This includes controlling and being able to manage potential impacts from pests and disease, also other impacts from climatic changes and whatnot.
Okay. Is that from a national urban forestry plan?
It's a national standard. I believe it's also within the NCA 300 standards. I'm not sure. I can look into that, but it's more or less an industry standard that we follow in urban forestry.
Sort of national standard, have they done any specific analysis of Miami Beach?
Of Miami Beach itself?
Correct.
No. I mean, this is something that we follow throughout the country, and it's a standard. The reason it's put into place is because it's shown, for example, up north, there's been cases where there's been specific species, for example, that has gone beyond the 10 or the 20% threshold. We've had other types of diseases, such as emerald ash borer, and other similar types of diseases. When they impact those urban tree canopies, it decimates tree canopy within that city. And so we're seeing that our palms, once again, 57% over, 57% as opposed to it having to be within the 30% threshold, are made up in our city. So, when we have disease and pests attacking these palms, you can have a detrimental effect on our palm species within our city.
Right. I guess the reason why I ask is there's only a handful of climates in the United States that can handle palms. I just wonder whether a national urban forestry plan was specifically looking at our climate, our tropical climate, Miami Beach, and also palms, because it sounds like, obviously, most of the country is not dealing with palm trees, so...
You look at it from the same aspect as any other species or any other family within the botanical realm.
And it just and Betsy, summed up some of the environmental benefits to the Urban Forestry Master Plan. But my understanding as well, and because doing my research and talking to some of the experts, as Mr. Fleming mentioned, is that when a palm tree is destroyed, for lack of a better term, that the CO2, the carbon dioxide, gets released back into the environment. So anytime we remove a tree, it has some detrimental impact back to the environment. Is my understanding accurate?
Yes, any time that a tree is removed, you're going to have a negative environmental impact. But one of the reasons that we have a mitigation plan as part of our ordinance is adding back tree canopy helps to reduce overall the net negative impact you have from removing that tree or palm. I want to note that when trees and palms are removed because of construction, it's because they're in direct conflict with the project itself. So a building, where that building is located, then a tree or palm is allowed to be removed per our city code. In neighborhood projects and park projects, you'll have trees or palms that are removed because of the project itself in order to achieve those goals of the project. Both public and private projects, they can't remove trees or palms just because. Rather, they have to remove, the only time that removal is allowed is if there's not another option. One of the things that Omar and his team, they do, they sit down with the landscape architects, they sit down with the arborists, and they make adjustments to those plans in order to protect the existing trees as well as palms on that property so that we are not seeing the environmental impact of removing trees or palms. First goal is to keep in place what we have. And I think that's established by our code as well as reinforced by the guidelines of the Urban Forestry Master Plan.
Thank you.
Commissioner Minor, let me just check one more time on the public.
And I do not at this moment see anyone present. Ah, sorry. We certainly have people present. Daniel Serrato.
Thank you for an opportunity to speak. Thank you. Daniel Serrato with Miami Design Preservation League. I think this has brought up some interesting concepts about resiliency and about environmental impacts. And Commissioner Minor has kind of brought some issues to light about sort of what is the overall impact of these new ideas and projects on the current environment. And maybe what we need to do in the future is look at sort of like a macro level impact of all of the things that we're doing and try to make sure that through all these infrastructure upgrades, et cetera, that we're building a resilient community, but also making sure we're not harming the environment on the way to that. So it's definitely a real challenge, but something worthy of looking into. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Joseph Z. Fleming. I previously spoke, and I just wanted to address this point. I agree with Elizabeth Wheaton when she says that we should add trees while at the same time preserving palms. I mean, that's the essence of this. We don't need to play the game that it's either or, because then we're on the horns of a dilemma. We're either protecting the palms or we're protecting the shade trees. So what she said was correct. I think that from the beginning, when I got involved in this, I checked with people that knew about this, and I'll just give you their names because they may help you and the city. I spoke to the president of Fairchild Gardens, Bruce Greer. He told me that he was bought over here, and I remember because I was on the board of the New World Symphony, for the creation of the park. He told me that he was brought over here, and along with others at Fairchild, he worked to have palms put in the park because they were not going to be a problem with high winds. He told me that, to the contrary, on the roof of the New World Symphony, they put some shade trees. They blew down. no discredit to the landscape architect, who is a different person but is well known for doing that, but Bruce Greer told me that the palms, in his experience, were the best. And I spoke to Dr. Charles Birnbaum, who's at Harvard and created the Department of Interior, which handles historic preservation resources and land use plan, and he told me that palms were invaluable. I gave his name. I gave the name of Charles Lee, who was the head of Florida Audubon Society, working on climate change for many decades, and he contributed information. I would encourage you to work with these people. And Carl Lewis at Fairchild, I'm not saying what they will tell you. I'm saying go talk to them, and maybe they will help you in working out these problems, because they have other ideas for achieving cover and shade, and using rooftops, eliminating black roofs, which we have in Miami Beach, in areas where you have heat islands. There are many things that are in the sustainability and forestry reports that are excellent. There are a few things that might be just, as you say, tweaked. So let's do it. And again, the best shouldn't be the enemy of the good. If we have an agenda item now and you can work with that, it doesn't prevent future overlays. But it's important that you take advantage of the resources you have, because unlike what's going on in the north with Dutch elm or some other diseases, some of the people who are palm experts will tell you that in this climate, palms are really important. And they also allow you to have viewscapes. So if you put shade and canopy all up and down Ocean Drive, the hotels, which are low-rise, would not really have viewscapes of the ocean. How do you sell an ocean front room? What do? Say it's a canopy front room? Why not just cover the windows and, you know, forget it? So there's a lot of things that you can do that are very positive, and I would hope that as we move forward, sustainability and forestry and the rest of us can get together, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Let's see if anyone else from the public. No, and no one else virtually. Let's bring it up here to either my colleague.
I'll just sum up. I think there's been a good discussion. I think anytime we try to implement a new policy, we should definitely have these discussions and talk about the pros and the potential cons. And I think we've had that discussion today and about the sort of the one size fits all and some of the issues we haven't really, again, allowing our residents to preserve their iconic palm trees in certain neighborhoods and allow them the opportunity to do that. But also looking at where we can mitigate some of the environmental impacts that would occur. So I'm happy with this discussion.
That's great. Thank you. And thank you for bringing this forward, Commissioner Minor. At this point, given the discussion, are you comfortable concluding the item?
I am.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we'll show item 7 concluded and completed at this point in time by acclamation. Back to the top of the agenda, we had a couple other items that were requested. We're going to next hear item number 2 and then item number 3. So number 2 is a proposal by CARE Resource. Commissioner Gongora is the sponsor. Commissioner, would you like to tee it up, or would you like to hear from the administration? You'll take it. Go for it.
Sure. I'll cue it up, and then I'll turn it over to Tom. This item was before the Land Use Committee last month, so it's not new, where we voted by acclamation to move forward and have our planning staff work with the applicant to come back with a proposed ordinance. For those watching, this came as a request from CARE Resource that provides medication to low-income patients, uninsured patients. And they have an office location at 1680 Michigan, and they're looking to legalize an in-house pharmacy. This has community support from a number of people, including from Lingo Park neighborhood. I think that probably everybody up here wants to help CARE Resource, but we're also very cautious that we don't open the door for potentially any other types of pharmacies that we're not looking to bring in the neighborhood. And it's my understanding that the applicant and planning have worked up a very detailed, precise, concise type ordinance, which may be able to do this in a safe manner. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tom to explain that further.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Gongora. As the sponsor of the item noted, this was discussed at the Land Use Committee at the last meeting, and the direction given to the administration was to work with the representatives of Care Resource to craft an ordinance that was very narrowly tailored. And that ordinance was sent out as a supplemental on Friday. We apologize for the delay, but there was a very tight turnaround between the last Land Use Committee and today's meeting. The ordinance itself, the city attorney's office has reviewed this. It is consistent with state law. When I'm done, I'll let Nick add anything that I may have missed. But it does establish a new subzone within the area that is essentially located between Lincoln Lane North and 17th Street and Michigan Avenue and Lenox Avenue. It's a very limited area and would create a very limited threshold for the allowance of both pharmacy uses and medical cannabis establishments. One of the key things to recognize, and we just wanted to make sure that we brought this to your attention, is that the size of the establishment cannot exceed 1,000 square feet. So whether you're doing a pharmacy or a medical cannabis establishment, it cannot exceed 1,000 square feet. The biggest difference, though, between this subzone and all the other zones in the city with regard to pharmacies or medical cannabis establishments is that in all the other areas, it is required to be a standalone use. And the reason that that was put in the ordinance was to be able to control the total amount of square footage. So whether you're a standalone medical cannabis establishment or a standalone pharmacy, you're a standalone use. And from an operational standpoint and an administration standpoint, you can better control that square footage. In this particular instance, however, both medical cannabis treatment centers and pharmacy centers would be accessory to a medical office, clinic, or health center. So while Care Pharmacy likely probably wouldn't have more than 1,000 square feet, if down the road a physiatry office or some other pain management medical office wanted to add a medical cannabis establishment accessory use, they would be limited to 1,000 square feet, and they would have to show that on a floor plan, but they would not be a standalone use. They would be part of a much larger office. So it's something that we would have to keep an eye on to make sure that they didn't try to expand that internally to increase that size. So that's just the only major difference between this particular sub-area and all the other sub-areas of the city that we wanted to make sure that the committee was cognizant of. Generally speaking, we don't have an objection to this proposal as it's very limited, and we would recommend that if there is consensus on this, that you send it to the full commission for referral to the planning board. If there's any more questions on the details of this, I know that the representative of Care Resource is here to take you through it in more detail. Nick, if I missed anything or you need to add anything, please do so.
Thank you, Tom. The only thing I wanted to add, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is that the ordinance has been drafted consistent with the state statute that requires that that we be no stricter as to cannabis dispensaries than we are as to pharmacies. And we've drafted this so that those two classes of businesses are treated equally.
Thank you for that, Tom and Nick. I don't see any questions at this point from my colleagues. So, Michael, do you want to
Tee it up for good us? Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard. Here I was in the applicant. With me today is Stuart Stein from Care Resource and my colleague Nicholas Rodriguez. As you all heard last month, the pharmaceutical manufacturers are now requiring the recipients of the 340B discounted medications to have their own in-house pharmacy. And as you all heard again, 80% of the revenue of Care Resource comes from this 340B program, so they need to act now. Care Resources' existing clinic, 1680 Michigan, is not without a permit. Is not within a permitted pharmacy subzone, and Care Resource needs an accessory in-house pharmacy to preserve its 340B program revenues. PJ, would you pull up the presentation, please? Thanks. Go ahead to the next slide. And next slide, please. So we are aware that any amendments to the dispensary regulations could cause some controversy. So we have gone out of our way and focused upon the stakeholders that are adjacent to us. So we have Palm View Neighborhood Association to the north, we have Lincoln Road BID to our south, and then Flamingo Park. Next slide, please. We have a letter of support from the Palm View Neighborhood Association. Next slide. We also have a letter of support from the Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association. Next slide. And although not in its final form, this is an excerpt from the agenda for the Lincoln Road BID. We appeared before them last week. There's a resolution of support forthcoming, but we wanted to show you all that, at least from the agenda, we are on the agenda, and they voted in favor of this legislation. So those are three significant stakeholders in the immediate area that are in support of this legislation. Next slide, please. As Tom was describing to you all, the boundaries of this subzone are very narrow, even narrower than what Tom described. 17th Street on the north, Michigan Avenue on the east, the northern lot line of the Lincoln Road parking lot on the south, and then Lenox Avenue on the west. Next slide, please. What we are proposing, this is the only change that I want like you all to consider, is typically there's a spacing requirement of 1,200 feet between pharmacies. What we want you all to consider is modifying that to reduce it to just to be the boundaries of our subzone, 600 feet. If we keep it at 1,200 feet, after this legislation is adopted, it is very likely we would have to seek a variance because there's a Walgreens just north of Dade Boulevard that we are within the 1,200-foot zone. So just one thing we'd like you all to consider is reducing the spacing requirement just for this subzone to 600 feet. That means that no other pharmacy could open up within our subzone without having to seek a variance from the Board of Adjustment. If this space requirement is not adjusted, then even after this legislation is adopted, we will still have to seek a variance from the Board of Adjustment based upon the fact that the Walgreens, which is a substantial distance, but probably within that 1,200 feet, just for your all consideration. The next bullet on this slide is, again, a reminder that in the code, there's a distance of 500 feet between dispensaries and schools. You have the Lincoln Martí School that's just northeast of us within the 500 feet. So even after this legislation is adopted, if a dispensary would want to try to locate here, in spite of all these restrictions, they would still have to go to the Board of Adjustment to seek a variance from these spacing requirements. It is unlikely that staff would recommend in favor, and it is unlikely that the Board of Adjustment would grant that type of variance. Third bullet, this came from Lyle Stern at the Lincoln Road BID, that the use must be located above the ground floor. Next bullet, the building has to be 25,000 square feet, an office building, at the time of adoption of this ordinance. Next slide, must be accessory to medical office. At first, we had just said medical office, but then Mike Lorente called me and said, Michael, would you please expand upon this definition and make it more precise? We are happy to accommodate Mr. Lorente's request, and we made it much more precise with regard to the definition. Tom touched on the next bullet, a maximum size of 1,000 square feet for the pharmacy use. No exterior signage, no retail sales, no alcohol sales, limited hours operation. And of course, most importantly, this is not a backdoor attempt to sell marijuana products here. We're saying that pharmacies cannot sell or distribute cannabis or cannabis products. With that, I'll be happy to answer any of your questions. This will be a huge help to Care Resource, and we'd appreciate your approval here today and referral to the Planning Board. Thank you very much.
Colleagues?
Just looking to our legal counsel, any objections to what Mr. Larkin just proposed? Any concerns?
Not from a legal standpoint. No, we've drafted it so that the two businesses are treated equally, and that's our biggest concern with ordinances on pharmacies or dispensaries.
I'm favorably
I'll move
disposed
it.
To go for it. So, yeah.
Clarifications. Looks like we're good on the legal side. Tom, this issue of the 600 feet that Michael mentioned, is the administration comfortable with that?
Tom, it sounds like we're okay on a legal standpoint. There was one point Michael mentioned for applicant. CARE's done amazing work, so we're very supportive of them. The 600 feet distance, is the administration comfortable with that as described?
Michael, is it 600 feet or within the boundaries of the subzone?
Either is fine with us.
Okay, because I think that, I mean, we can work that out with him, but we don't have an issue with it. I think maybe just saying within the boundaries of the subzone, because it's a very small subzone, you won't be able to get another one, and the other subzones are more than 1,200 feet away. So we wouldn't have an objection to his proposal.
Okay. With that, I see a motion. I see support. We can show that done by acclamation, favorable recommendation to the full commission to be referred to planning. And on that one point, we, the applicant and the city administration will work through the final language.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners. We appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you. Next up is item number 3. Discuss a proposal pertaining to a city parking lot. Commissioner Gongora is the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll set it up and then turn it over to Tom to fill things in. This came to me actually from the landowner that owns that series of hotels between 10th and 11th on the west side of Washington Avenue. As you may know, the city has a small asphalt parking lot on 10th and Washington. It currently can, I believe, hold 37 cars. I've personally never been able to park there because it's always packed when I drive by. But since we are looking at ways that we can improve Washington Avenue, in meeting with them, they came up with an idea where we could create workforce housing as part of a partnership, a private-public partnership, something that I have been very focused on. It's somewhat frustrating at our Affordable Housing Committee how few options we have. And then this creative idea came where we could turn an underutilized asphalt parking lot into a building that could provide 33 one-bedroom units of workforce housing focusing on the art community, more so musicians, as well as provide more parking than is currently there and some more attractive features for the street. If this receives a favorable vote today from this committee, then I believe the next step is that we would move the concept forward to the Finance Committee. I believe that they have the jurisdiction, which you two both serve on, to review the terms and see if it is something fair and to determine whether or not the Finance Committee believes you should partner with the adjoining property owner or do a formal RFP. So I'll turn it over to Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Gongora. As the committee may remember, you discussed this proposal very briefly at your last meeting, and direction was given for the proposer to come back with some modifications. My staff did meet with the proposer and their architect, and they have revised the drawings, and they've addressed most of what we had suggested were our concerns, particularly with regard to the front setback. However, there are a couple of things that we still have a concern with, and I just wanted to outline those briefly here. The proposal itself was sent via supplemental last Friday. Again, because of the short turnaround, we apologize for not making it part of the agenda, but it was sent to you, and I believe that the applicant will take you through it in more detail as part of a PowerPoint presentation. First, the administration is not supportive of locating parking below grade. This is 32 spaces, so obviously that would be a policy decision, but we do have concerns with locating parking below grade. Secondly, on the north side, we have some concerns with their proposal to bring the building so close to the north property line. And the reason for that is because it does not create a lot of space. Unlike the east side of Washington Avenue, most of the buildings on the west side of Washington Avenue, and in particular in the 1,000 block where this is located, the buildings have good separation. They have good light and air corridors. And in this regard, we do believe that there needs to be some more space. This would result in a loss of approximately 15 parking spaces in the upper levels, as well as some tweaking of the commercial level, commercial space at the first level and the interior spaces on the upper levels. We don't think that would be that significant, but we do think that it would be important to get some more space on that interior north side. With regard to the overall height, the administration and concept is supportive of the proposal to go up to 75 feet, as we believe that is about the only way that you would be able to accommodate the setbacks that are going to be needed and get a worthwhile use such as workforce housing. However, we would recommend if this ends up moving forward, and this is something that would be looked at as part of the Historic Preservation Board review of the project, that the upper levels be further tweaked and fine-tuned. Perhaps there's a way of further setting back the upper levels, particularly from the west side facing the RO district and perhaps the north side facing the adjacent parcels, which are slightly shorter. And then lastly, while square footages were provided as part of this, we would need more detailed FAR calculations as part of any proposal that moved forward in order to ensure that it met the FAR limitations. Because this is a GU parcel, depending on how the deal is structured, this would either be a sale that could potentially be the rezoning of the parcel, or it may be developed as a GU parcel that would take an average of the development regulations of the surrounding area. So that is something that we would need to get more detail on if and when this move forward. If there is consensus on land use to move this forward, as Commissioner Gongora correctly stated, this would need to go back to the commission for a referral to the Finance Committee.
Michael.
I wanted to add also that while I support the concept, I also have concerns and do not favor the below-ground parking. So I wanted to put that out there. But I am in favor of working on a concept that can meet approval.
Thank you for that.
Ricky, do you want to go? Michael, you don't like the underground parking? You said you didn't like it?
No.
Oh, that's one of the things that I love the most about it. Yeah, so I'm really intrigued by this. You know, without getting into the financial aspects, I haven't really viewed it from that perspective. I just looked at the design and what's proposed to be built here in terms of workforce housing and office, both of which we want, and it addresses parking by burying it underground, which I know is a very expensive and, you know, it's a massive engineering feat in our community. So, you know, my hat's off to someone who wants to undertake that that kind of undertaking. And the fact that they want to invest in the MXC district on Washington, you know, again, my hat's off to this development team. So I look forward to seeing this progress. So I'm strongly inclined to support and help shepherd this through.
Yeah, let me thank you for that, Commissioner Arriola. Let me tee up a few points. I know we have some folks here that would like to speak, and we're going to hear from the public, but maybe some of our comments might be helpful in terms of addressing it. I, too, am open to the subterranean parking. I think it adds value to the project. It adds parking. Interestingly, the risk is to the private property owner, not to the city. And what I would encourage the applicant to work towards is there some way that even that subterranean parking in a disaster could almost serve as an asset to the city. I mean, water is going to go somewhere, and maybe that can even be somewhat of a reservoir. So I actually would like to explore that. I think that's interesting. I take Tom's planning comments seriously about the distance to the north line, so I think that's something we would like to hear more about. In terms of the workforce housing, that's obviously an important goal. I'd like to describe a few categories of employees that employees actually jump out to me as important. We have an item coming out of a budget that we just did where we're setting aside $150,000 for our police officers. So, you know, this is pretty close to our police headquarters. I think it's real close. This is an area that is very code intensive. Maybe our code enforcement folks could be part of this. So while artists and music are obviously delightful, that's an intriguing idea, I think there are some practical needs, and I would like to see how the proposal could address that. I think the opportunity exists, particularly if we do include subterranean, for more parking, so there is a benefit. I think it's important that we have outreach to the Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association. Maybe some of that's happened, but, you know, how do they benefit from this? What are the advantages to them? And, Tom, just a question. You said action by this committee, and I sense there likely would be, to refer to the Commission to Finance. Could you just walk us through the path, specifically, how many votes are required, ultimately, if we came to a concept we wanted to proceed with?
You would need to, it would be four votes to refer it to the Finance Committee, and then the Finance Committee would make a recommendation with regard to their proposed term sheet and also whether or not to waive the competitive bidding. When it comes back to the Commission, my understanding is that it's a 5-7 vote to waive competitive bidding, and then if the lease is going to be more than 10 years, it would be a 6-7 vote as well as approval by the Planning Board.
Okay, thank you for that. And so just my headline, 5 to get to that other step, but 6 ultimately. 6 to me is compelling. 6 is a no-brainer. Has to be absolutely clear as day that this is in the city's best interest. With that, let's hear from the applicant.
Thank you, and we appreciate it. Graham Penn, Burkow, Riddell, Fernandez, Larkin, Tappanus, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard. I appreciate the wisdom already, and as you all know, this is early days in this process. So our request is exactly that this committee recommend to the commission to refer this item to the September Finance Committee so we can see the time ahead of us. But for the sake of the committee and for the public, we have a PowerPoint. If we could put that up, PJ, I'll go through my portion of it quickly. Next slide, please. Just get to the first aerial. Jose Gomez, our architect, is with me, and I apologize for not announcing him earlier. Next. Yeah, I'm going to be here for a couple seconds just talking about what P13 looks like now. As you all know, P13 is 37 surface parking spaces, and we took a look, courtesy of the parking department, on the revenues in this, from this property. So pre-COVID, we were looking at around $200,000 a year in revenue from the parking there. And that's basically been very stable pre-COVID. Next slide. This really gives you an insight as to why we're excited on behalf of WPH Properties, who's the owner of the Washington Park Hotel. We think there's a lot of great synergy that can be created with this whole block being incorporated in one, essentially one development. That is really the reason that we're coming forward with this proposal and the reason why we think we are uniquely situated in being the proposer here, in that we can integrate this lot into the overall assemblage in a much more coherent fashion. And I know this administration has told me that they've been looking at this lot over decades for what can be done with it, and it's very difficult to do much with it on its own, given its size. It's only 15,000 square feet. But integrating it with the hotel complex, we think, can be much more successful. We're open, obviously, to discussions regarding subterranean and not subterranean. We've already got civil engineers working on enhancements to stormwater retention. And I think, to your point, Mr. Chairman, as a point of reality, subterranean parking in the event of a catastrophe, when the water is high enough to be flooding all of our streets, will function as a cistern in that sense. And by that point, if we're talking about a hurricane, all the vehicles have been removed, they've been put up into the higher levels that exist, or they're gone to their homes. So again, we think it can be, in normal times, we've got a great stormwater solution, and in catastrophes, we think it will be helpful. So let me shut up and let Mr. Gomez get up and take you through the design briefly. These do incorporate some additional changes that we made last week as a result of our discussions with historic preservation staff and with Tom. But of course, we're early days in this, and this is just conceptual at this point, and we will continue that conversation. We've also met last week with MDPL, and we will be attempting to meet with the Flamingo Park Association at its July meeting. I've got to send Scott that email. I wanted to get past this meeting before we set that up. But Jose, could you come up, please?
Good morning, Commission. Tom. Jose Gomez, Balance and Gomez Architects. We're the conceptual design architects for this project. Can we go to the next slide, please? So this is a model showing the levels and what are we putting in this, all these levels under the 75 feet. We're proposing a basement with stackable parking, 64 spaces, ground level with sort of back of house commercial spaces, two levels of parking, tandem spaces, three levels of residential, and one level of corporate office,
with a small rooftop pool. Next, please. This is the existing site. It has 37 spaces. Next. Next. These are the properties just to the north of us. As you can see, they're all lined up, and we, original design, we were actually encroaching in that setback, that visual setback that we have. And now our building aligns with all the buildings to the north, respecting the architecture of the existing. Next, please. So this is the building right now, our conceptual design. The exterior on three sides of the building will be fully louvered to protect with sunshade devices, to protect from the sun. On the east, west, and south facade, the north facade, we do not have the louver system. On the bottom, you can see the commercial wrapping around on Washington and on 10th. Next, please. We're trying to activate the Washington facade, the corner areas. It could be the commercial, could be resident, could be retail, could be F&B. Just trying to activate the bottom level. Next, please. So this is our basement plan. Again, this is our tandem and stackable parking, 64 spaces. We're proposing, after listening to the comments from staff, a cistern on the northwest portion of the site. We're also proposing two bioswale areas adjacent to the cistern and in the front of the building on the east side of the property. We're also would provide, we feel that our civil engineers have been leading us to provide maybe a well, an injection well, in addition to the bioswale and the cistern. Next, please. So this is the ground floor. The building is surrounded. It's lined with commercial, and the back of house, the entry to the parking is through the alley on the west side of the property. To access the parking will be fully valet. There will be two elevator car lifts to all of the levels of the parking. Next, please. I also wanted to point out, this is a second floor, but I also wanted to point out that one of the comments perhaps has not been reviewed yet by Tom. We did move the building or reduce the width of the building by 5 feet, just like the building to the north of us. So now we have a 10-foot separation between our building and the building to the north, something that was previously discussed. I don't think we've engaged in a conversation with staff to show them what we had done yet, as the drawings came out on Friday. Next, please. We can go one more time. So this is a typical level where the units could be designed as an apartment, or we can design it, we can split them in half and be able to create the micro units. Next, please. Rooftop pool, there's a small amenities for the building and perhaps the guests to the for the hotel to the north of us. Next, please. These are the elevations. It's a little bit difficult to see here unless you really study it in detail. This is the louver system facing east. Next, please. Same. This is the south elevation, all surrounded by the louver for sunshade devices. One of the things I wanted to point out here is another comment that we've taken from staff, is that from the second floor, the building starts stepping to the east. So we're stepping away from our neighbors on the west by 8.5 feet, I believe it is, on the ground floor, on the second floor, and 15 feet on the second, on the from the third up. Next, please. This is the north elevation. This is the area that we step back away from our neighbors to the north. And the area on the bottom right is a landscape area with the cistern and some bioswale area in that corner. Next, please. And this is This is the west elevation. A little difficult to see here, but this is where you start seeing that the building starts stepping back towards the east. Next, we'll see it in the 3Ds. This is an aerial of the entire project. As you can see, we're aligning with all of our buildings and respecting that view corridor to the north. Next. This is looking southwest, and again, other than the 10 feet, we also made a gesture to remove a portion of the building and create more light and ventilation through that courtyard that you see on the residential levels. Next, please. This is just a render image from Washington. Next. You're starting to see here how the building, the effort of moving the building from away from the north so that we have the same setback from the building to the north than our building. So it's 5 feet, the building to the north, to the property line. Ours is 5 feet as well. We get a 10-foot corridor between our two buildings. And then also the space that is taken out in the back to kind of soften that the space between the two buildings. Next. Here you can see a little better where the third, from the third level up, the building is stepping back. Next. And again, from this image, you can see how the building is stepping back from the alley and from the neighbors to the west, 15 feet away from our property line. Next. This is a section just to show you how the building is stepping back from our property lines. Next. Again, all these studies have been and hoping to keep the building away from our neighbors. Next. That's it. That's my presentation to you. It's very conceptual. It's a direction to hopefully get this thing going. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Let's see if Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel Serralda with Miami Design Preservation League. We met briefly with the applicants last week, and we wanted to thank them for their time. We overall thought the project was interesting and want to learn more about it. Obviously, that lot is owned by the city, so there might be potential to redevelop it. And like the Commissioner Gangora was saying, with workforce housing and other things that we wanted more of in our city. So that sounds like a positive. I did want to mention just a couple of concerns for further study. One is that there is a large shade tree on the west side of the property. So we'd love to know if the applicant would be willing possibly to relocate the tree either on the property or somewhere nearby. We think that'd be great. Also, some concerns about the impact on Flamingo Park neighborhood to the west. So definitely will be important to meet with the Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association. We have many treasured Art Deco buildings in the vicinity, so we want to make sure we protect those from any unintended impacts. In addition, there is some concern about adding more retail on 10th Street, where currently there isn't any retail. And, you know, we know that certain new retail has had a negative impact on the area. I'm not going to mention any names in particular, but we've heard about some of those. So one thought is possibly on 10th Street that rather than having retail there, maybe that could be more of a liner like in some other projects like 300 Collins. Any changes to the program will obviously change the overall financial deal. So it'll be interesting to see what's being proposed, whether that's a sale or a lease. And we appreciate the planning staff's comments about the setback from the property line. We also think they should look at the Alton Road overlay where the new Baptist Urgent Care was built. There were some additional setbacks to limit the impact on Flamingo Park. And in summary, we look forward to hearing more about the project and more outreach with the public and going from there. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Daniel. I don't see anyone else from the in-person public. Let me just turn over to the Zoom, and I don't see anyone. I just have a couple reactions that I'm going to recognize the sponsor. I like a lot of what I heard. I think the call for additional outreach, good that you're going to Flamingo Park, is important. I think we want stormwater management on steroids, so bioswales, cisterns. I think the administration's guidance there is appropriate. I underlined the importance as it relates to housing for safety and enforcement, police, code. And finally, you know, from a safety standpoint, right now we have a parking lot. It's a busy parking lot, Commissioner Gongora told us, but there's not a lot of activation. So one of the public benefits here, frankly, could be activating that space in a way where there's some foot traffic and activity. So I think there's a lot to like. The devil's in the details. Commissioner Gongora, you're the sponsor, if you'd like to speak.
Sure, thank you. I think it's an interesting concept, which was why I placed it on the agenda. And I'm more interested after seeing your presentation. I think it will be a positive for the neighborhood. I think you can work through the design comments with administration as it moves forward. As Daniel mentioned, this requires significant community input and outreach on your part to pass land use changes, especially if you're looking for the more than 10-year lease, which I suspect you will with a 6/7 vote. It's a high threshold. So I look forward to a robust dialogue. And with that, I'd like to move the concept forward and place an item on the June 23rd Commission agenda on consent to refer this to finance and get the ball rolling.
And I see thumbs up. So, Tom, we can show that done by acclamation.
Okay. And, Commissioner, I will I'll go ahead and draft that for a supplemental. I'll reach out to the mayor's chief of staff to see if the mayor will approve it. And if not, it would just require a 5/7 vote to add it to Wednesday's agenda.
I'm hoping not to go down that road again, so let's see if it gets added.
Wonderful. Okay, so that item is concluded. Let's get back to item number one, Ocean Drive MXE Land Use and Zoning. Mayor Gelber is the sponsor. Tom, could you kick us off?
Sure. As the committee may remember, this particular referral, which was made last year in 2020, contained three separate parts. The first part was proposed amendments to Chapter 142 MXE use regulations. That traveled through to the Planning Board and was adopted by the City Commission on May 12th. However, it did not include the proposal to require CUP approval for entertainment establishments that were indoors that were below an OCC load of 200. The second part of this component was the parking exceptions for residential and hotel uses in the MXE district. This also went to the commission and was approved in May, but only for residential uses. The exception does not apply to new hotel construction. The last component of this is a proposal to allow for strategic height increases along the east side of Collins Avenue in a manner that would facilitate and encourage new hotel development within that area. And the purpose of the height increase, as we detail in the memo, is to allow for new additions that would hopefully connect to properties on Ocean Drive as well as provide for enhanced views on the east side of Collins Avenue looking over Ocean Drive. This particular component was referred to the Mayor's Art Deco Cultural District panel, was recently discussed by the panel last Friday as part of a comprehensive set of potential zoning recommendations that have been put together by the city's consultant, Ziskovich. The panel did not make any formal recommendations because there were so many different things that were proposed by Ziskovich. So we don't have a formal recommendation from the Art Deco Cultural District panel on this particular item. With regard to moving forward, the committee could either move this to the full commission with a recommendation. This still would require approval from the Planning Board. If you would prefer to hear from the Art Deco Cultural District panel, my suggestion would be that you would move this to your September meeting so that the panel has enough time to render a recommendation before that meeting.
Colleagues, I'm happy to have a conversation here. That said, I'll just start with, I given we have a panel going, I would be of the mind to let them weigh in. I'd rather hear it in September once they've had the chance. It seems a little inconsistent. We're going to go one way. We don't know which way they go. So we could talk about it, or we could say, let's hear it in September. I lean towards September. Strong opinion for me to make.
You're okay with that? You okay to...
Okay. So, Tom, let's just show this moving to September so that we can hear from the mayor's panel.
By acclamation, we'll move this to the September LUSC.
Okay, that's great. Let's talk about flooding here, and we are on item number 5. Real basic intro, and then I'm going to turn it over to Nelson. We obviously have important investments in resiliency. Cities dealing with flooding from a variety of sources. We have groundwater, sort of sunny day flooding. We've got rain bombs. We have storm surge. And I think it's especially important that as we approach neighborhood projects, that we have some understanding of the flooding we're dealing with. With that, Nelson's done a good job at laying out what the city has been doing. Look forward to the conversation and presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioners, Nelson Perez-Jacome, City Engineer. What you see before you today is a memo describing pretty in-depth the data we collect, but for a high-level overview, staff was instructed to go out and look at what other cities do. We looked at cities, our neighboring cities, such as Miami, Miami-Dade County. We also looked at cities that are similar to us, such as New Orleans. And what we found was that they were measuring flooding with a system of sensors similar to the one that we once upon a time presented here in land use. The sensors were pinpointed around the city. It wasn't exactly comprehensive. It was just specific locations. They were rather costly, and cities such as New Orleans and Miami-Dade have gone away from the center, municipalities such as Miami-Dade. Cities such as Miami use them to measure certain canals, but they've also found that there's limited benefits from using those sensors to measure the levels in the canals, because what they found was what we found when we installed their groundwater monitoring wells, which is that the level of water in those canals are directly proportional to the tidal levels that we get from Virginia Keys tidal gauges. So we went ahead, we laid out all the various items that we measure currently in the city without an expansive system of sensors, and we measure data that's collected through complaints through CityWorks. We measure data that's collected through our own system of gauges that we already have installed, such as 14 groundwater monitoring gauges across the city. Each of those sites have 3 separate groundwater monitoring wells for different depths. We also measure rain gauges that we have in the city, and we also collect data historically throughout the Jacob study. For example, we went ahead and we analyzed low-lying roads as compared to 25 years of sea level, and we were able to accurately pinpoint where flooding had occurred. We presented before you just because we thought it would be germane to the current discussion about our program moving forward. Two examples. Those two examples are Town Center and Normandy Isles A. We could do the same for other neighborhoods throughout the city. We just thought these would be good examples to use. And we showed you that we know the number of flooding incidents that have occurred and flooding complaints that have occurred in those neighborhoods. So we went ahead and after putting together all this data, we basically concluded that we do have a good amount of data that informs not only the long-term strategy of our program moving forward, but also the short-term decisions that we have to make when we deploy temporary relief measures such as temporary pumps or addressing backflow preventers where we can. And what we recommend is that the capital cost of $750,000, the recurring cost of $120,000, it doesn't seem like it would provide any level of benefit beyond, you know, significantly beyond what we already accrue. So we recommend concluding this item, and we'll be happy to report what we measure on an annual basis, kind of year-end overview.
Yeah,
going forward.
Thank you for that, Nelson. And you have been responsive looking at the other cities. You know, it sounds like we're not ready to recommend that level of commitment, which was consistent last time we talked about it. So overall, I'm, you know, leaning towards your recommendation of the LTC. Could you focus us a little bit on Town Center. That's such an important project. Sure. We could be talking about $100 million plus right. investment up there. And I guess what I'd like to know, I see we have some data in the attachment. Could you, two parts. One, what do we know about what's happening there today in terms of the various type of flooding? And two, because there'll be some planning, there's going to need to be design. What actions can be taken to get the best level of a needs assessment, a baseline for Town Center?
So, Commissioner, I'll address the first question. I might have to ask you to expand on the second one
sure.
just to make sure that I understand your question. But the first question, we do have a good amount of data, especially on Town Center versus other areas. If you refer to the attachments with the map, you'll actually notice there's less critically low roads in Town Center as compared to, for example, Normandy Isles. So what we analyzed in the report was the number of times that roads below 2 feet would have flooded, and that was, I believe, a total of 6 times in the data we analyzed for this memo specifically. But there's other levels of analysis that could go on because, you know, we exhibit tides at 2.2, for example. So we didn't comment on how many times it was 2.1 versus 2.2 or 1.7, right? So this was just a high-level overview. But at a high level, Town Center does have higher roads that are less susceptible to tidal flooding than Normandy Isles A. I would want to understand what the second question was a little bit better.
It really was just to build on that. Given that we have sort of a direction that's our next project, mm-hmm. we have some time. Part of that planning effort really should be sort of the needs assessment. What additional data and analysis at maybe the next level of detail can we begin capturing, given that that's the project in front of us, both to sort of firm up the need, understand the issues, and importantly, set us up for the pre- and post-measurement?
Understood. The pre- and post-measurement, that's the easiest one to answer. We've developed a policy for all projects moving forward. We've implemented it in West Avenue. We're going to implement it in First Street. We are going to do a pre- and post-model for every project moving forward that would show how flooding was exhibited prior to the project. And the design engineer or the design builder, depending on methodology, would be incumbent upon them to provide an accurate post-development model to show that we would not ever worsen the condition of any single property, right? Drainage improvement projects have to improve the conditions of the drainage. From a needs assessment, I think we've done quite a bit of needs assessment. We have a water and sewer, comprehensive water and sewer master plan that addresses needs in that neighborhood moving forward. We have a stormwater strategy, a concept plan presented by Jacobs. I think the next level of needs assessment really is getting down to a conceptual design, which we don't have yet, right? I mean, we have to get to a certain level, maybe a 10 or 15% design, where we lay out these are the options. This is what it looks like if you do all the water and sewer. This is what it looks like if you just do drainage. This is what it looks like if you do both of those, as well as other infrastructure above ground, beautification, lights, things of that nature. And it would require some engagement with the community and some interaction to do that.
Okay, thank you for that. I wish we were in a different financial place. I wish the censors were hitting it out of the park more than I'm hearing our current thinking is. But with that, I'm ready to conclude the item and have the annual LTC, give us the updates as recommended. So unless colleagues have anything to add to that? No? Then we will show that done by... Thank you for that, Nelson. Let's go to item number 6, the Palm View Neighborhood Study. Right now, on the Palm View Study, Tom, planning is listed, so I was going to bounce it over to you anyways.
Correct. Mr. Chair, this item has been pending for some time. It was last heard by the committee at your March 24th meeting, and at the request of area residents, it was open and continued to your June 21st meeting. The discussion is also pending at two of our land use boards. The planning board is scheduled to discuss this item at their meeting tomorrow, and the Historic Preservation Board will be taking this up at their July meeting. And the last time that this was discussed by the Land Use Committee in March, The committee made a recommendation that the resiliency and infrastructure recommendations put forth by the consultant KCI be separated and brought to the commission for discussion, which we did at your May meeting. The commission asked us to then have a separate meeting with the area residents so that we could go over in more detail both planning and the Public Works Department. The recommendations pertaining to resiliency and infrastructure that have already been completed, that are scheduled in the short term to be completed, and those recommendations that are envisioned to be part of the longer term Jacobs priority list. And so we're in the process of scheduling that meeting with the residents. Due to their travel schedule, that may not happen until the fall, but we certainly are open to having a meeting in the summer. The remainder of the proposal that is before this committee and the land use boards primarily pertains to the land use recommendations, and the main ones that everybody is aware of, obviously, are the proposal to potentially de-designate the area as well as to upzone portions of the area, and then lastly, to potentially change the classifications of some of the homes based upon the year of construction. So that is what's pending before you. We did reach out to the residents of the area to see whether or not they wanted to have this discussion today. That they indicated that they did want to have the discussion today. So some of them, while I don't see them in the chambers, they may be on a Zoom call and they may want to address the committee via Zoom.
And Tom, just to frame it a little bit, because you know, it's been a while since we heard from our consultant. The item currently doesn't have a sponsor. From a land use standpoint, if you had to tee up the one or two big questions in front of us, how would you summarize the issue?
The two biggest issues clearly are the proposal to de-designate Palmview, and there's a number of reasons that the consultant recommended that. I know that there has not been consensus among the residents of Palmview on that. There are some residents of Palmview who are supportive of that, others who are not supportive of it. The other major issue is an upzoning, whether or not to upzone the areas that are currently single family to some form of multifamily, whether it be townhome or RM1 or even RM2. And I think those are probably the two most significant issues. Both of those issues would require voter approval. So if the commission did want to entertain those in some way, the commission would first need to place one or both items on a ballot, and the voters would have to approve those before the commission could consider them.
Okay, that's helpful. Since a lot of this is coming from the residents, I do see Stefan Genet is online. I believe he is a member of the board. I'll let him clarify if he's speaking for the board or as an individual. Let's recognize Stefan for at least 2 minutes to hear what the neighbors think, given the work so far. Stefan, you're recognized.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning. My name is Stefan Genet, and I'm the resident and board member of Palmview. We appreciate our city's effort and commitment to its Rising Above program. Unfortunately, just like the two previous citywide studies, this report is not addressing specifically the future of our single-family homes in regard to sea level rise. We have since initiated a dialogue with city staff and MDPL to consider options. One of our main concerns is whether single-family homes like the one in Palmview can be raised at a cost that makes sense to account for sea level rise. We are aware of the upcoming grant program next month to get an appraisal of adaptation to sustainability and will participate. We would like you to consider ordering two studies. The most important one to us is at this time, before we would talk about zoning change and de-designation or anything else, would be, can single family home be raised at a cost that makes sense and under which conditions? According to city staff, this has not been done in the city except for one very expensive property on Star Island. The cost of raising a house could easily be more than 50% of the value of the structure. At that time, FEMA and state code could request a full upgrade of the property to current code. This could add a lot to the cost. The city building department has not done a full determination at this time of what the raising of a single family home could trigger as far as additional code requirements are concerned. Legal department would also probably have to give its opinion as regarding the cost of raising a house and if it could be so expensive that it could trigger a birth heiress claim or something similar. Finally, we'd like to find out, would any funding assistance, be city, county, state, or federal, be available to help the homeowners, as we are talking at a cost that we estimate to be from a few hundred thousand to more than $500,000 per structure. This report is crucial, as we will not find a path forward without an independent report that could be accepted by the resident and the preservation organization. If raising homes is not a reasonable alternative, we will need to consider other options. We would like your board to request an estimate for the cost of study to raise single-family homes so it could be considered for your budget, as I'm not sure if staff feel comfortable doing this internally. The second study would be to find ways to streamline the cost and process for any application for a single-family home to go in front of HPB and consider some form of credit system, if any. Right now, the process to go in front of HPB or DRB is the same for commercial and residential properties. If commercial properties can count on future income to recoup their cost of going in front of the board, it is not the case for single-family home like the one in Palmview. We're not asking to take away any prerogative of the HPB, but are simply asking to make the process less painful for single-family homeowners in historic districts when it comes to preparing our home for sea level rise. This report will also be beneficial not only for Palmview, but also for West Flamingo and Flamingo Park, as they also have single-family homes. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Stefan, and thank you for the active engagement from the Palmview neighborhood. I believe what I heard was two specific requests. One, and I'm going to sort of add to it, it sounds like, you know, what's the future of single-family homes given resiliency, given the flooding that we could be incurring, and specifically, what is the cost to raise a single-family home? And then the second was around streamlining the process for HPB. If my colleagues want to weigh in, or Tom, if you want to help us on those two issues,
sure.
What we might do.
First, on the study regarding the cost of raising single-family homes, it's really tough to dial into an exact number because every single-family home is going to have its own unique set of characteristics. Their footprint is going to be different, whether or not it's a slab on grade as opposed to raised with a crawl space, whether it's primarily wood frame construction, the existing structural condition of the home. There's a whole set of factors that go into it. If you did order a study, you know, obviously that's a policy decision and would have budgetary implications, but assuming that that was done, someone would have to basically pick a sampling of homes within the area and then do a study, but that again would not likely provide a true representation of what other homes might face. So we wouldn't want people to think, okay, this study shows that it would likely be this amount, then they propose to raise their home and it ends up being a lot more. And so that's some of the things to consider with regard to that. Regarding the cost and the streamlining of HPB, obviously that I don't think you really need to study that. It's a matter of rather from a policy standpoint, you want to significantly reduce or even eliminate the fees associated with going to HPB for properties in the Palmview area. I don't know if it would be that significant. The fee is typically $2,500 plus the cost of mail. I think if the commission wanted to conclude that this particular area, because of its unique situation, should be exempt from single-family fees or exempt single-family homes from HPB fees or have a significant reduction in HPBs for single-family homes, you probably would want to do it not just in Palmview, but in the other limited single-family districts as well. There aren't that many other single-family districts, so I would suggest that you would probably do that there.
Thank you for that, Tom. Let me just see if either my colleagues have any initial reactions here. Yeah, go ahead, Richie.
So what's the action specifically we're looking to have here today? Just a discussion?
So this, as you may recall, stemmed from a larger discussion that the city had with the residents of Palmview. About 2 years ago, the city hired KCI, the independent consultant to do kind of a deep dive into the Palmview area and look at everything from resiliency to single-family development to preservation. KCI came up with a number of recommendations, which were then presented to the commission. The commission last year then referred the report to the Land Use Committee, to the Planning Board, and to the Historic Preservation Board to get their recommendations on the proposal. We then, once we have all of the recommendations from both the Land Use Committees and the Commission Committee, the administration will come back to the commission with those recommendations, and then the commission can decide whether or not they want to take action. So basically what we're looking for is your recommendation.
I mean, look, so with respect to this neighborhood, I'm sympathetic to many of the homeowners that I've spoken to who, you know, I'll use my own words, you know, feel trapped in their homes. For most Americans, their home is their financial nest egg, and many of these folks, you know, are in homes now that don't have a whole lot of value in today's marketplace, and in light of rising sea levels, probably don't have a great future prospect either. And so the question becomes what happens to their financial nest egg? And because it's been designated as a historic neighborhood, they're very restricted in what they can do with their homes. And I don't feel comfortable as a government and as an American who believes in property rights, you know, forcing them to basically just live with a situation that's been imposed upon them by a previous commission. I would like to find ways to provide them some relief, and I'd like to talk to my colleagues about, you know, how we move forward in the future with these kinds of designation in light of sea level rise, because it is overbearing on a lot of homeowners and a lot of the folks that I've spoken to, and I'm sure everyone here has as well. You know, they're getting up there in years and they want to plan for their financial future. And, you know, this has been a very onerous designation on a lot of folks. And there's questions that have been raised by some of them that, you know, maybe there was a lack of due process or procedure in how this was designated, you know, I guess close to almost 30 years now. So I would like to find some kind of path for these homeowners so that they can get some relief from the designation, so that they can do things with their homes so that they can last another 50, 100 years. Because otherwise, they're going to be worthless at some point. So that's where I'm leaning on this very heavily.
Commissioner Gongora?
Yeah, I think you summed up the concerns that a lot of us have. This neighborhood needs some help. There's a lot of homeowners that would like to do something different with their homes, but because of the historic designation, they can't. I understand the flip side, that there's people that want to keep the historic designation. It's so problematic that I wish there were some way that on a case-by-case or home-by-home basis, there was some method to evaluate what would be the appropriate thing to do. But there isn't, because everything I hear from administration is the only option is to put it on a ballot and see if the voters de-designate it as historic. I haven't really heard any great solutions. So it's one of these things that our hands are tied and we don't know what to do. I heard you say something, Tom, that you don't think there's consensus in the neighborhood for what they want to do. I guess I'd like to have the most information and data possible. I'd like to see what the Planning Board does with it tomorrow. I'd like to see what the Historic Preservation Board does. But I'm pretty sure they're going to say keep it historic, but we should hear what they have to say. I also think that we should go back and update some kind of public outreach or charrette in the community. I'd be happy to go out there and speak with them. I'd really like to go back out into the neighborhood and meet with them and see what their solutions are. And we're going to have to move this out of this committee to the full commission eventually and make a decision. What are the solutions? Is the only solution to de-designate? And if so, does the commission have the appetite to put that on the ballot?
Yeah, if I could just follow up. Tom, so first off, on the second issue of streamlining with the HBB, I would be amenable and would request that the administration come back with what those specific costs are, order of magnitude, you know, across citywide, doing that fairly. So I think we can handle bucket number two pretty easily, and I'd like to add that into our dialogue. On number one about how to help these single-family homes, you know, besides this route of de-designation, which would need to go to voters, does the administration have any other ideas or anything from the consulting report that we might consider?
As is the case with any historic district in the city, and I think that we're going to be facing this in the decades to come, the Historic Preservation Board does have the authority on a case-by-case basis to look at these homes individually and decide whether or not they're going to issue a certificate of appropriateness for demolition, whether or not they're going to allow the home to be razed, to be substantially modified. Clearly, over the years, the previous Historic Preservation Boards have taken a more conservative approach with regard to modifying the homes in this area. Now that we've completed the Boyan City guidelines that from Alan Shulman, we believe that moving forward, the board is going to have more tools with which to utilize where they can hopefully be more flexible and not just have a knee-jerk reaction of you have to keep that home in place and you can't do a thing. So I think that part of it, I think, is going to be educating the board on what the different options are and encouraging the board to be more flexible with an emphasis on preserving the important scale, character, and context of an area, but allowing for homeowners to do what they need to do to make the properties more resilient and to adapt the properties to future changes, not just in climate, but also extreme rain events, extreme tidal events, and other things that currently pose a danger to that. That clearly is what we have the ability to do now. And short of the voters approving amendments to the code that remove HPB authority, I think that's what we are going to need to work with in the short term.
Thank you. Let me see if we have anyone from the public that wants to speak here on this.
Yes, thank you, Daniel Serrato with Miami Design Preservation League. So we've been through this process, and we've been working with some of the owners in Palmview. Now there's sort of two emerging groups, one for, one against de-designation. But, you know, I think I agree with some of the comments here to sort of wrap it up, move it on. Obviously, we wouldn't support a de-designation going on the ballot, and if it did go on the ballot, we wouldn't, you know, suggest the voters to de-designate because we do believe that resiliency and preservation can be complementary. And I think the different studies that have been done by the commission have proven that. Just the fact that we haven't had any requests from that neighborhood for an actual demolition over all these years kind of gives the idea of what the owners are looking to do or not to do. And I think to the extent that we can help continue educating people, I know we had a couple owners in Palmview who had been quoted $10,000 annual flood insurance. And when we met with them and referred them to some other insurance providers, those costs went down significantly. So I think to the extent we can continue educating the homeowners and working with the city on incentives and just realizing that there aren't any properties flooding now, there aren't any homes there that are flooding. You know, so we have to keep that in mind when we broadcast that all over. There actually have been a lot of recent sales at record prices in the neighborhood, partly due to the movement south. And several of the new homeowners also, I think, would be unhappy to learn about plans to rezone. So it is a very, you know, delicate situation, but I think that we're moving in the right path in setting this issue and finding the incentives that we can add to make the neighborhood resilient. Thank you.
Does anybody else from the public, Commissioner Ayala, any suggestions?
I'm not sure where you were going with your comment, but one thing you said, at some point we have to put this before the whole commission to decide, and then eventually, if we so are so inclined, to put it on the ballot. And that's the sort of only ultimate recourse, then we just have to explore that. And the longer we wait to actually make a decision, we hold this whole neighborhood in limbo. So I would be inclined to take action. And I don't know if that's where you were going with that, but that's where I would go.
Yeah, I agree that we need to move it out of this committee. I would say let's see what the planning board does. I would ask staff to perform a public charrette, and after that is concluded, to take it out of committee to the commission. And I'm stepping off for a minute.
Okay.
But that's my motion.
Sounded, Commissioner Arriola, that was sort of in line with your thinking.
Yes.
Because we have had a committee, it's probably a good time. I do think we need that outreach to hear from the various groups within Palmview. Maybe it's just one view of it. I think it's important that the preservation community engage with the Palmview so that we, you know, can get to something that is constructive. Then I think we're going to have to look if some of the work, as Tom referred to with the buoyant cities that Alan Schumann did, could be helpful in that or not. Then we'll look to try and move it out of the committee to the full commission to see where the body wants to go. No easy answers on this one, but I think we're taking the right process. And I think the motion and the sense of the group here, I think, is a reasonable next step.
So to confirm, did you want to go ahead and move it to the full commission with that direction?
No, I thought the charrette was to come back to here. What was your – you spoke. I was away from the day.
Yeah. I'm inclined to move this to the full commission for a more robust dialogue just to see where the rest of the commission is at. This is something that the neighborhood has been dealing with for a very long time. It's been this committee for a while. They've been in limbo, and I think we owe it to the neighborhood to have a more vigorous discussion, probably at the full commission. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at.
I don't have any objections to that. I'm not sure what Commissioner Gongora specifically where he wanted those results, but I would be fine with that. So I'm comfortable to bring it to the commission. As I said, I think we do one last round of outreach. I'm fine to move it out of committee. It's probably one we should hear from our colleagues on as well. Obviously, it'd be good to get the community input from our preservation community, all the boards that would need to opine so that we could have a productive discussion. So, Tom, I think the answer to your question is, giving Commissioner Arriola, who made the motion, his will, if I heard it right, was would the summary of all that would go to the full commission. I'm supportive of that.
So just to confirm, we're going to move the item to the full city commission. We will make sure that the Planning Board and HPB provide their recommendation before the commission takes it up. And number three, we will have one more outreach meeting with the Palmview neighborhood. So we probably won't get this to the full commission until September so that we can make sure that both the land use boards give us their recommendation and that we have at least one more meeting with the community.
That's great. At that meeting, or in addition, it would be great if we heard from the preservation community. Maybe that's part of that meeting, or it's an add-on to it. You know, sometimes there's no middle ground. Sometimes there just isn't. It's always best if parties could come together with a practical, constructive action. Otherwise, I think, you know, we'll do it at the Gang of Seven.
Yeah, we Commissioner, we will make sure that MDPL is included in the community meeting so that they can be part of that discussion.
Okay. Let's show that done. At least the two of us were firmly on it. I think Commissioner Gongora was. But I don't know if he was okay moving to the commission. But I believe he was supportive of the overall direction as well. So,
okay, I can ask him when he comes back.
You could confirm that. I just don't want to speak for him. But I think he was ready to move forward, and hopefully that captures the spirit of what he was looking to do as well. And then, Tom, as part of that, right, we also were going to take the streamlining of the single-family home. Let's keep that. I think we could keep it committee. That should be an easier one.
Yeah, maybe what we could do is in September, we can bring back some options for reducing the fees for single-family homes and give you an idea of what the cost implications would be.
That's perfect. So we'll add that into that
motion. That'll be by acclamation.
Wonderful. So that concludes item number six. And Tom, check me here. Let's see.
I think we only have one item left,
yeah,
Commissioner,
item nine.
Which is item nine.
Yeah, that's Commissioner Steinberg's on sanitary sewer water infrastructure. And I think we were just going to have a brief headline on this one. And go ahead, Nelson.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioners. Nelson Perez Jacome, City Engineer. Like you said, it's just a brief overview. What I've provided is a memo detailing some of the key critical BMPs that we practice on a strategic basis, the operational, the design and planning, as well as the stakeholder BMPs. And what I'm here to report is that I'm very pleased with the best management practices that our team practices. I think operationally we go above and beyond. Some BMPs, such as the clean stormwater system, are far in excess of the MPDES requirements. That's just one of the my favorite to say. As well as doing innovative infrastructure, such as advanced metering infrastructure, which is going to provide a much better level of service to our customers while allowing us certain enhancements that will help us operate the system in a more efficient way. From a planning and design perspective, we have the master plans. We're implementing blue-green infrastructure, and we're implementing hybrid stormwater treatment systems that really are at the forefront of what we do as civil engineers. And from the stakeholder perspective, I don't mind telling you, in all my years of consulting for all the major municipalities here in the county, Miami Beach goes above and beyond. We have an excellent communications team that really does engage the stakeholders. So the administration at this point is happy to answer any questions, and we do recommend to conclude this item, and we'll proceed with trying to provide the world-class service that we always strive to achieve.
Thank you for that, Nelson. Let me see if there's anyone. I don't see any members of the public. I don't see any hands raised. It sounds like we had a good, productive summary, and the recommendation is to conclude the item. Commissioner Arriola, anything to add? Are you okay with that?
Let's conclude, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're going to conclude it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Tom, do we have any other items, anything you need from us, or are we...
Will the meeting on the 12th, July 12th, start at 9 o'clock?
Yeah, thank you for that. We are going to confirm a time change, Monday the 12th, 9 a.m.
Perfect.
And with that, this meeting is concluded. Thank you for everyone's help.